You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 8th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Evan.
Jay.
Steve,
what is
Bob.
Up, everyone?
Kara.
Hi.
Happy post-Halloween.
Thank you.
Why are you so chipper if it's post-Halloween?
Aww.
Well, that's because, Bob, Thanksgiving is, what, 2 weeks away, and
who cares?
Thanksgiving so
you are
much.
You are the chief pilgrim of Thanksgiving, Jay.
I truly do love it. I actually yearn for Thanksgiving.
Is it the food? Like, why do you love Thanksgiving so much?
It's the food, of course.
Gotcha. I won't
and it's
be
New
here.
It's a very New England thing as well.
You're gonna be down under or something, right?
Oh, that's right.
I'll be in Wellington. I'll be in New Zealand.
Wellington.
The first time we were in Australia was over Thanksgiving, and it basically doesn't exist in Australia, so we missed it.
I was fine with it.
Yeah, I was in London once on Thanksgiving, but we found a little pub that was serving turkey. It was really cute. Yeah. It wasn't an American traditional turkey, but it was like in honor of our American friends. We're like, oh, thanks.
That's very thoughtful.
Jay, it's just a big family dinner. We have that like, what, every 3 days? I mean, come on.
Oh, that's yeah, so but nice. It's
a collection of lots of different things that I like to eat all at once, though, Bob.
That's true. We don't eat enough turkey and cranberry sauce and stuffing.
Well, and what about like sweet potato casserole? How often do you actually make that at
that's
home?
True.
Yeah.
Never, but I order it from Boston Market frequently.
I could see that. It's so
Thanksgiving
good.
In New England has an extra little appeal to it because we are, you know, deep into the fall season, just the smells of the wood fires burning everything else that sort of goes hand in hand with it.
And all the leaves are so beautiful where you guys live. It's actually like orange and red outside.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
This was an unusual year foliage-wise. I'm a big fall foliage dude. If I'm driving in October and I see a gorgeous tree, I will stop and take a picture and send it to various friends. I mean, that's how much I love it. This year was bizarre. Tell me if you guys agree. I mean, I'm driving around. It's like, you know, first off, it seemed to take a while to get going. Then it kind of entered that, I call it the burnt phase, where things were just kind of like, the colors were like muted and not bright anymore. And now it's like there's been a resurgence in the past few days of like bright leaves coming out again. And I think it was this heat. I mean, we had an October that I have not experienced in my lifetime of like 60s, 70s, sometimes even 80s. It was insane temperature wise. Yeah. It was way hot. I think the trees just said, what the hell is going on? And it kind of messed it up. I don't know what
we used to call that Indian summer in less culturally sensitive times.
Yeah. We still have beach days into November. It's weird. And then in the following year, it's kind of yucky. They call it jute and gloom because it still feels like sort of yucky, springtimey. It doesn't get to be summer until kind of late. But summer just lasts a really long time. But I think that I was reading a new article that just came out about 2017 being either the hottest year on record or in the top 10 hottest years of – yeah, top three
surprise,
hottest
surprise.
Years of all time ever on record. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the warmest year without an El Nino we've ever had. Hmm.
I wonder what's
without
causing
the El Nino.
Oh, yeah. Who knows? It's probably isn't human
it's a hoax.
Caused.
It's all natural, guys.
Yeah, there's a giant hoax causing climate change.
Solar wind.
Right, we only think it was really hot.
Planet X, all sorts of things.
Planet X. Mm.
Here's the best weather for brilliant fall foliage. So you want a good growing season, a lot of moisture over the summer, but then a dry, cool, sunny autumn with warm days and cool but frostless nights.
Uh-huh. Did you just bring that from memory, or is that a recipe you had written somewhere?
Google
that. Definitely read that.
I'm reading it off of AccuWeather.
It's a tattoo on his arm.
I never say autumn. Obviously, you do because you have an autumn.
Yeah,
but
my younger daughter's name.
Autumn rain.
Yeah. But I never
I go back and
use
forth.
The term autumn. It's always fall to me. I wonder if that's a southern thing.
Probably.
Or maybe. A Kara thing.
I use
both.
A lot of those.
Depending on context, but I tend to prefer autumn. All right, Kara, get us started with what's the word?
Ooh. As I always say, it's a fun Kara, one this week.
It's fun. I'm already having fun. I don't even know what it is.
I can't help it. All right. So the word this week is ontology, and it was recommended by Louis from Australia. I love this. He says, I often come across the word ontology or ontological, and although I have a loose idea of its meaning, I'm still a little hazy. I struggle to find a clean distinction between ontological ontology and existential existentialism. I know this is starting to creep into the realm of philosophy, but I thought it might be an interesting one to discuss. Well, we love philosophy on the SGU, and I love this word because I also study psychology, and I think it speaks to a lot of what I am tackling right now in some of my classes. So Merriam-Webster and Oxford both use the term metaphysics in their first definition. They say it's a branch of metaphysics that's concerned with or deals with the nature of being or relations of being. And then they both have a secondary definition. Merriam-Webster's secondary says it's a particular theory about the nature of being or the kinds of things that have existence. So they're kind of talking about it as a discipline. And Oxford sort of says the same thing in a different way. It's a set of concepts and categories in a subject area or domain that shows their properties and relations between them. So there they're sort of using it as, like, I don't know if analogy is quite the right word, but like, what's new about our ontology is that it's created automatically from large data sets. So they've sort of taken the true definition of ontology and applied it to like modern businesses. But really, when it comes down to it, ontology is a branch of metaphysics. So we're talking about a philosophy here, and it's a philosophy that specifically focuses on the nature of existence, the nature of being. And I think it'll make even more sense as we break down the etymology and as I compare it to some other philosophies. So it's the Latin word ontologia was created in 1606 by Jacob Lorhard, the German philosopher. And its first occurrence in English of ontology as an actual English word was found in a work by Gideon Harvey in 1663. So we know exactly who coined these and we could find it in their written work. But if we break down exactly what the prefix and the suffix mean, we've used logi many times. That's the suffix. That's a speaking, a discourse, a doctrine, a science, or a theory. So, you know, Steve is a neurologist. He is a, you know, a person who studies and practices within that field. But onto means being or existence. So I think we've done the word on the show before. Correct me if I'm wrong. Ontogeny. You guys remember ontogeny? We talked about phylogeny too. Yeah, exactly. So onto, meaning being or existence, and then geny, which means origin. Ontogeny is the biological development of an organism. It's how it, you know, develops, grows, becomes its adult form. Whereas ontology is the discourse, the theory, the philosophy of existence or meaning. So don't mix those two words up. So Louis, what I would say to you is I think it's actually more important to note the distinctions between ontology, epistemology, which was last week's word, if we aired these in order, and phenomenology. Ontology is concerned with the nature of being, the nature of existence, like I said. Epistemology is the nature of knowledge, and phenomenology is the nature of consciousness. I think that those three often get mixed up because they sound like big, weird philosophy words that are somewhat similar, and they feel a little bit vague. But if you can keep straight, ontology, nature of being, epistemology, nature of knowledge, phenomenology, the nature of consciousness. But I do understand why it might be confusing, ontology versus existentialism, because the nature of existence is in the word existentialism. But if we think of existentialism, it's a much more modern branch of philosophy and psychology, like 19th and 20th century. It's not monolithic. All existentialist philosophers and psychologists have different views, but it focuses on central themes like freedom and responsibility, understanding mortality, the burdens and the beauty of being alive. A lot of the philosophers like Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Sartre, Camus, they were labeled as existentialists, but most of them after they were already dead because they didn't really call it that back then. So the way that I would think about it is that existentialism is a specific type of ontology. So you know how like a square is a rectangle, but a rectangle is not necessarily a square? You guys correct. Have heard that, right? Yeah. Sure. So existentialism is an ontology, but ontology is not all existentialist in nature.
Yeah, it's basically thinking about what stuff that exists in the universe.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it also doesn't necessarily deal with science per se. Yeah. It's almost before we start applying scientific principles. It's really the philosophy of like what it is to exist. What does it mean for something to be? What is nature? You know?
Oh boy. And then
they're some of the most fundamental philosophical questions. And then science is sort of a tool that we use to actually look at these kinds of questions with data and with evidence.
Yeah. But you could talk about, like, in a very narrow sense within the context of science, you could talk about like the ontology of things that exist in the solar system, like
Absolutely.
Planets and moons and asteroids and comets and whatever.
Yeah, and then you're just talking about their very core nature.
Right, or the difference between a planet and a dwarf planet would be a matter of ontology.
Yeah, and also probably a matter of, I'm probably using this word wrong, but taxonomy as well. That's more for biological
things. That's classification.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Right, so although you can loosely use like taxonomy of planets, you know, if you have,
good.
You can use that sort of out of context like that as a just any kind of classification system.
Yeah, and a similar word, but it's used in medicine that refers to the same thing is nosology, right?
Nosology, yeah.
Yeah, it's how you classify diseases.
Right.
Anyway, too
and
many
noses,
words
and
this
noses.
Week. And noses, yeah. nosology. There you go. Nosology.
Well, speaking of nosology, actually, that leads very nicely.
Speaking of nosology?
Yes. The next
topic,
which is about celiac disease, or more specifically, not celiac disease, meaning non-celiac gluten sensitivity. You guys hear that term before?
Yes.
Non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course. A lot of people around LA.
Not surprised about that, though.
Yeah.
Celiac disease is not controversial. That is a sensitivity, essentially an immune reaction to a component of the protein that makes up gluten. Gluten is a combination of proteins found in wheat, rye, barley, and similar grains. One of those proteins that make up gluten is called gliadin, and celiac disease typically is essentially you make antibodies to gliadin. So you're essentially having an allergic reaction to the gliadin component of gluten, and that causes a lot of problems. You know, it causes GI problems and other symptoms. People who have celiac disease who eat gluten get very sick, and it could really, you know, destroy their quality of life. And they essentially have to go on a gluten-free diet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for some reason, actually we kind of know the reason, but you know, in the last decade or so, the notion that maybe a lot of other people who have GI symptoms or other symptoms that don't have celiac disease may still have a sensitivity to gluten. And going on a gluten-free diet has become all the rage. In fact, in one survey a couple of years ago, one-third of Americans self-identified as being sensitive to gluten or were trying to avoid gluten in their diet.
What? Why?
It was a thing.
It's part, I think, of this broader clean eating movement,
mm-hmm.
which is the notion that you have to avoid chemicals and toxins and anything bad in your food. You have to eat good food and avoid bad food. You have to eat clean, but it's almost entirely nonsense.
I know. Bread is so good. There's nothing evil about bread.
Right. You know, gluten just became a bad thing that you had to avoid. There really isn't any convincing scientific evidence that the non-celiac gluten sensitivity exists as a specific pathophysiological entity, meaning it's a real and separate thing. That then leads to a deeper question. Well, how do we know, right? How do we know if a disease exists or not? That's actually a very interesting and complicated question. And, you know, it comes up specifically because there are many, in fact, dubious diseases, right? Diseases that are not generally accepted as existing, like chronic Lyme disease, for example.
Fibromyalgia.
Fibromyalgia is a really weird one. I don't think it really exists, to be honest with you, even though...
It's more of a syndrome?
Yeah, because it's kind of linked to like depression and other sort of like various somatic problems.
Fibromyalgia was initially proposed as a possible like low-level autoimmune disease affecting the muscles and the fascia, like a myofasciitis causing chronic pain. And
my
the diagnostic criteria included having specific trigger points, meaning that there were specific locations in the body where there was very focal tenderness. Like there were these 18 different points and you had to have a certain number of them had to be specifically tender.
Okay.
But the problem is that people started using the diagnosis as what we call a garbage pail diagnosis.
Yeah.
That whenever anyone had muscle pain that was otherwise unexplained, they would call it fibromyalgia, even if they didn't have trigger points. But of course, without the trigger points, there really was nothing specific to that. It was a very non-specific, vague syndrome. And so a few years ago, what happened was that the, you know, the Rheumatological Professional Association essentially dropped the requirement for trigger points in the diagnosis. So they officially made it an actual garbage pail diagnosis, right? So now you don't, it is just a vague, otherwise unexplained myofascial, you know, chronic pain. In that way, it's kind of like another entity called fever of unknown origin, right?
Yeah.
Which is exactly what it says. You have a fever and nobody knows why. You know, the standard workup for what might be causing your fever is negative, so we don't know why you have a fever. And I also think chronic fatigue syndrome is the same thing. You have chronic fatigue and we don't know why. We're going to call that chronic fatigue syndrome. If you have myofascial pain and we don't know why, we're going to call it fibromyalgia.
It doesn't mean there's nothing wrong with them.
No.
It just means that we don't know what it is yet, and we don't know if it's a constellation of symptoms or
no standard treatment for
it. It's a placeholder label for a clinical syndrome without a known specific pathophysiology, which usually means that it's multiple things.
That's what I'm thinking. So my sister, you know, has been diagnosed with fibromyalgia over the years, and she takes medicine for it. But she's also obese, and she also struggles with depression, and she also struggles with just like various somatic complaints that I think just kind of come along with being generally unhealthy. You know what I mean? And so
it's hard.
Like her joints hurt all the time. Well, yeah, but she's carrying extra weight. And it does seem like there's so much interplay between severe clinical depression and somatic bodily complaints. And isn't one of the treatments for fibromyalgia an antidepressant?
Well, there are. Yeah, but it's
complicated.
There's two FDA approved drugs for fibromyalgia, Lyrica and Cymbalta. Cymbalta is an antidepressant, but it's also used to treat neuropathic pain.
Gotcha.
So it has a double indication. So it actually could be treating the pain aspect of it and not just the depression aspect of it. And of course, not everybody with fibromyalgia is depressed.
Yeah.
But I think it's multifactorial, and there's lots of things that can lead to it. A lot of people with fibromyalgia just have bad sleep. They have chronic insomnia. And if you treat the sleep, the fibromyalgia goes away.
Oh, interesting.
For example. And you're right. Some people just have multifactorial risk factors for just overall bad health. And if they, you know, lost weight and exercised and, you know, treated
other
things,
they might not be in so much pain.
Then it might get better. But then, you know, even when you nibble away at all these other possible contributors, there are some people that are left behind. But we don't really know what's causing it. They just have, you know, chronic myofascial pain.
Interesting.
So there may be some discrete entities in there, but we haven't identified them yet.
And that's where you hear people getting all like, it's about an inflammatory diet and it's
that's
own
crap.
Body.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's
what,
these
syndromes, these vague syndromes that are like, again, these placeholder labels that are just, you know, we're just calling this clinical syndrome this because we don't have anything more specific to call it because we don't understand, you know, necessarily all the various different causes for it. They are ripe for exploitation by gurus, by, you know, marketing, by, you know, again, like the clean eating thing.
Sure.
By charlatans, by, you know, every alternative medicine practitioner. They love to treat these sorts of things because you take somebody who has symptoms that, you know, the we don't understand well enough to give a very specific diagnosis to. They give it a falsely specific label. I mean, that's why I don't like labels that imply specificity that doesn't exist. And then they say, this is what's causing it, and this is how we're going to treat it, and we're going to make you better. And then that just sucks them into, you know, fake treatments for a fake disease. Again, that doesn't mean their symptoms are fake. It means that the label is not something specific and therefore does not specifically relate to a treatment. So a lot of people who self-identify as non-celiac gluten sensitivity, you know, that's probably a very multifactorial group as well, including a lot of non-specific syndromes, maybe undiagnosed diseases, maybe lifestyle problems like chronic sleep deprivation or, you know, chronic insomnia, et cetera, or just, you know, anxiety causing GI problems or lots of other things. Or maybe even, and in there, I'm sure there are probably some physiological things that we don't fully understand yet.
And also some people are on special diets from their doctors that include it as part of all the other things. So that's really frustrating too, because somebody goes to a physician with GI problems and they say, oh, you should be on a FODMAP diet or you should be on a this diet. And it includes not eating gluten within all the other requirements.
Yeah.
So you're right. They're not controlling for variables.
Yeah.
And is it the fact that you're avoiding FODMAPs, which again is just a different type of compound that may be, you know, in some people the real trigger and not the gluten. Or is it just that you're eating less, you know, is it you're thinking about what you're eating for the first time in a while, or you're doing other things, you know, to maybe address your symptoms. So you need to do carefully controlled trials to isolate variables and so that we know what variables are an actual thing. And so the question then is, if you want to say, does the, you know, gluten sensitivity, the non-celiac gluten sensitivity exist? People saying, oh, but I stopped gluten and I felt better, that doesn't answer the question.
No.
Right.
The only thing that answers the question is, when you fully control for that isolated variable of gluten, does that make a reliable difference? And we do know the answer to that, and the answer is no. There's been multiple studies, and I think the best studies we have so far. So we could say one thing is that we don't have a pathophysiology. So if you're going to say that it exists, you at least have to have a discrete clinical syndrome. And if you're the discrete clinical syndrome includes sensitivity to something, then the best studies to answer that question are re-challenge studies, where you say, okay, we'll take away the thing that you're sensitive to and see if you get better. And then we'll reintroduce that thing and see if you get worse again when we reintroduce it. But we're going to do it in a placebo-controlled fashion. So some people will get reintroduced the thing that we're studying, and other people will get reintroduced a placebo, something that should be inert or not should not trigger it. And when you do placebo-controlled re-challenge studies of gluten versus placebo, not gluten, you get results that are all over the place, that are highly mixed, and there's no real statistically significant difference between the reaction to gluten and placebo. So not convincing evidence that exists. It's basically negative, but it's very what we call heterogeneous, meaning that the results are all over the place. There is no consistent result there. So that's all, in my opinion, consistent with this not being real. Again, that doesn't mean that patients who have symptoms don't have real symptoms, they don't have a real diagnosis, or that changing their diet didn't make them feel better. It means that the best evidence we have suggests that it's not gluten. Gluten is not the thing.
Yeah.
Non-celiac gluten sensitivity may not exist as a discrete clinical entity.
Interesting. Because also, like, if you stop eating gluten, if you think about it, you're also not eating as many calories.
Almost certainly, yeah. That's probably true for a lot of individual people, sure.
Yeah, like, you know, I mean, not to be too general, but if you eat a lot of bread, it kind of makes you fat. So, like, if you don't eat as much bread as pasta all the time.
It depends on how you eat it. It depends on how you eat it. Like, if you're eating an extra 500 calories a day in bread with your meals, and then you stop eating those extra 500 calories, it's going to make a huge difference.
That'll make it. Impact. That's right.
But I need to eat bread with my pasta.
I know.
Yeah, right. I know. Yeah. Starch and starch and starch.
I love carbs.
All right. But here's the other thing is that.
There's another thing?
Yeah. So going on a gluten free diet is not exactly benign.
Huh.
So, first of all, it may be expensive. It also could be very difficult, I mean, to avoid gluten, although it's getting easier because, you know, so many industries are catering to the gluten-free fad, so that actually has made it a little bit easier. But still, you know, imagine avoiding all wheat, rye, barley, and, you know, similar things. Plus, restrictive diets are hard to do without becoming deficient or insufficient in certain nutrients. Like, it's possible it increases the risk of being folic acid deficient or iron deficient if you are trying to have a gluten-free diet and you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
There's been a recent study linking a gluten-free diet to an increased risk of type 2 diabetes. I would consider that preliminary, but that's a legitimate concern that needs to be followed up with further research. And people on a gluten-free diet may eat fewer whole grains, you know, and there are, again, so they're essentially having a less varied diet in a specific way because they're trying to avoid an allegedly bad food. So it shouldn't, I wouldn't consider it to be a benign thing to go, hey, let's just go on a gluten-free diet and see what happens. It's not without its risks, even just in expending resources of time, effort, you know, sometimes even money. And there may be dietary disadvantages to it. So these fads do have their consequences. Also, I think it's very important to recognize that it's likely that some people who end up self-diagnosing as having a gluten sensitivity actually may have something else that needs to be identified and treated, but they're delaying or even avoiding the real diagnosis because they're latching on to this fad. I see that happen all the time, more with me as a neurologist with the like things like chronic Lyme disease. I have people that I see are convinced they have chronic Lyme, but I'm convinced they have something else. I may not know what it is yet, you know, but I need to complete a workup. But if you stop sort of looking for an answer when you think you've found it, and if it's the wrong answer, well, then you're not going to find the right one. You're not going to find the right diagnosis.
So and there's so many GI problems. Like you could have Crohn's, you could have diverticulitis, you could have all sorts of things and not know it.
So fad diagnoses that people latch onto and settle onto prematurely do a lot of harm, in my opinion. And then, you know, when you try to, you know, say, hey, let's, you know, do the science and think about this in a very clear way. And unfortunately, I think the reaction is, well, you don't believe me. Or are you saying my symptoms aren't real? And it's like, nope, that's not what we're saying. But of course, the gurus encourage that interpretation because they're always trying to play an us versus them. Yeah, the evil mainstream physicians don't believe you, but I believe you. I know that you have this real thing and I'm going to fix you and make it better. It's all so predatory, you know. But the other thing is once these things get into the public consciousness, it's really hard to get rid of them, you know. It's
like antioxidants.
Antioxidants have a health halo that will last for generations. Gluten now has a baggage associated with it that, you know, will take generations to go away if ever. Like for example, yeah, it's just really hard to undo these. There's an asymmetry here because, you know, people who are making money off of misinformation and trying to correct the misinformation, you know, there isn't a huge financial incentive to do that often. So the misinformation tends to have a significant advantage in the marketplace of ideas. And, you know, if we do the research, it takes 10 or 20 years to like really definitively answer the question, then they move on to the next thing, you know? It's an endless cycle. They'll get 10 or 20 years out of whatever fad. And yeah, until the science shows that it's BS. By then they're on to the next thing, which will take 10 or 20 years to research thoroughly.
It's whack-a-mole. It's in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Exactly. All right. But that's why we're going to keep doing what we're doing. Keep plugging away. All right, Bob, this is an interesting story. I'm not really sure what to think about this yet. Let me know what you think about wormholes. Did scientists actually discovered a wormhole?
Well, in the ground. I will let you know what I think.
So, in space?
Yeah, gird your loins on this one. This one's a little heady.
I'm excited, man.
I love that expression, gird your loins. So scientists have proposed that traversable wormholes may be created that won't collapse upon themselves. This could not only theoretically allow for some type of wormhole transport, but more practically, it could help solve major mysteries of black holes themselves. So this was developed by Ping Gao and Danielle Lewis Jaffris from Harvard University and Aaron C. Wall from Stanford University, who all wrote the paper on this. So they claim that after coupling the two boundaries of eternal BTZ black holes, we find a quantum matter stress tensor with negative average null energy whose gravitational back reaction renders the Einstein-Rosen bridge traversable. So isn't it that awesome?
Why didn't I think of that myself?
That's the quote of the week, I think.
So we're all geeks. We've all heard of wormholes. God, we've talked about them on the show plenty of times. So these are predicted by general relativity as shortcut passageways through space-time, potentially allowing for a type of time travel as well. The problem is that these wormholes would collapse in on themselves if assuming you can even fit inside. So what's the classic solution to that? It's always been for as long as I can remember, really, that if you line the throat of the wormhole with exotic matter, it would hold it open and make it stable and traversable.
Like a stent?
So, the kind of, yeah, absolutely, man. So, the problem.
I always thought that was erotic matter. Nearly as exciting.
Steve, you check your browser. You're on the wrong website.
So, the problem is exotic matter is some weird shit. It would need negative mass, which would have strange characteristics like accelerating in the opposite direction of an applied force.
No, I've seen that, Bob.
Yeah, right? So I'm sure you haven't. So needless to say, there's been no hint of it anywhere. You know, they're not finding this stuff. It's just really not there. So this new theory posits that no exotic matter is needed. Their math seems to say that if there is a quantum connection between two black holes, the wormhole created between them would automatically have this required negative energy of there to hold it open. So you don't need this incredibly problematic exotic matter that this sort of quantum wormhole could supply its own. So what's exciting is that this quantum connection allows for this traversable wormhole. Now, it's similar. Now, you might be saying, what do you mean, this quantum connection? It's similar to a quantum teleportation, which we've also mentioned on the show. And it's been demonstrated. Quantum teleportation is a thing. I mean, just like I think last year, Chinese researchers teleported a photon, the specific properties of a photon from Earth to an orbiting satellite 300 miles away. Now, quantum teleportation basically transmits this quantum information, such as the exact state of an atom or a photon, from one place to another. But to do this, you need help of other things. You need classical, slower than light communication. And you also need to have some sort of a previous quantum entanglement between the sending and receiving location. So all of that is very, very similar to what they're talking about in these two entangled wormholes and their quantum connection between them. And also, do not get your hopes up. If classical communication is part of the equation, then that means that faster than light travel or communication cannot happen within this scenario. Just wipe that from your mind. But that's fine. To me, that makes it actually seem even a little bit more plausible, if they're kind of wiping that out from the get-go. Cheer up, though, because some of the most exciting outcomes for this is not the wormhole travel aspect for people, which probably will probably never happen, but it's other things. For example, this theory could offer solutions to a sticky problem like the black hole information paradox. Because if you've got this quantum information trapped in a black hole and then it evaporates through Hawking radiation, right? Stephen Hawking came out with that, I think, was that in the 70s or the 80s? So where is this information going? I mean, it may take giga years, billions of trillions of years for black holes to eventually evaporate. But this information, though, is where is all this going? There's a principle within quantum theory that says that information is never lost. That's a unitarity principle. And that's something that these physicists do not want to give up. But somehow it seems to get lost with the whole idea of evaporating black holes and Hawking radiation. So some theorists have posited a literal firewall around a black hole's event horizon. If you guys heard about this, I think we talked about it briefly one episode. So that's kind of an attempt to solve the information problem, in that anything that hits the event horizon gets kind of like burnt into a crisp by this firewall that's kind of around the event horizon, just kind of frying it immediately. So, but I know that was a really odd theory, but it could mean, it also has some implications that are kind of weird. For example, that black holes have no interiors, right? I mean, if nothing is getting through the black hole and nothing is in there, there's less than nothing inside of these event horizons.
What? My mind is blown.
Like, yeah, it's like a rip in space-time, an end of the universe. It's like, it's kind of crazy.
Non-existence?
And, yeah. So, and, you know, physicists don't like that either. So, you know, you try to solve the information paradox and you have this other wacky stuff. So if this theory is correct, though, perhaps, you know, if information can get out of a black hole through these quantum traversable wormholes, then it could preserve the interiors of black holes and maybe also resolve this whole information paradox. So yeah, I mean, this is took a while to wrap my head around this, and I wish I had even a couple more days to really nail it, and I'll definitely read more about it. But check it out online. There's a lot there. Even the original article is dense as hell, and man, whew, that was a tough read. But still, there's lots of lay interpretations of what's going on. So check it out. It's fascinating stuff.
But this scenario would not allow you to fly a spaceship through a wormhole and go across the universe.
I mean, if you're assuming like, okay, crazy high technology, I think there are still people like Kip Thorne who kind of knows what he's talking about, that think that it will, everything seems to be pointing to the idea that people are never going to be able to traverse these wormholes, even this traversable one. If it's doable, it might be something, you know, it might be some sort of quantum information that can be sent through, but it's not looking, not even with this, it's still not looking great. At the very least, even if we can't traverse a wormhole, we could would find out what a black hole truly is. And that, I mean, that's, come on, black holes are one of the coolest things ever. I mean, so that, oh, yeah. I'm cool with that.
That movie from the 70s? Oh, gosh.
the Disney one? Oh, my God.
Come on, what? It was good.
No, it wasn't.
It was good back
Jay,
then.
Are you kidding me?
I have not seen this movie.
It's called Black Hole.
Yeah,
it's Max. Called The Black Hole.
Max. Remember the robot, Max?
I'm sure. Yeah, it didn't exactly
withstand
the test
of time. Yeah, but Steve, we all knew it wasn't going to hold up. You should never rewatch it. Let it exist, you know, in your mind.
I did that recently.
Don't watch The Dark Crystal. Just let that sit.
Oh, that one hurts.
Yeah.
That one hurts, actually.
You know which
Steve?
Other one you shouldn't rewatch, guys? Flight of the Navigator.
Oh, really?
It's so bad. Which is really sad. It's my favorite movie.
Here's another one.
But Dark Crystal, man.
Was Total Recall. The original Total Recall.
I heard it was bad.
Quaid.
The thing is, that movie was awesome back then.
At the
back
time,
in the day.
And now
it was
sucks.
Not just good. It was like, holy crap.
Schwarzenegger, good. Sharon Stone, you know, had some good things going for it.
Oh my God. totally not holding up. I saw the remake like a few years ago and it wasn't that bad. I kind of enjoyed it. But I only saw that once. Maybe that didn't hold up because it's been a while, but I kind of liked it. I mean, my expectations were quite low, though.
That helps. That does help. All right, Jay, this is a very preliminary study. I mean, this is a basic science study, but they're making some claims about, you know, rejuvenating cells. What's going on here?
Talk to me.
So Professor Lorna Harris, who is a professor of molecular genetics at the University of Exeter, has discovered a novel way to rejuvenate inactive senescent cells. A senescent cell is a cell A senescent cell, Steve, is a cell that can no longer divide or multiply. I'm just kidding. Can no longer divide, but is still alive and metabolically active.
Sounds like a spent chicken.
Yeah.
It's like, senescence in men is when it's like women go through menopause and men go through what they call senescence, meaning it's when you're no longer fertile.
Right. That's right. So this cell can't divide, can't duplicate itself. And it still has a metabolism, but it's really not doing much beyond that. And several hours after the cells were treated with this specific chemical, which I'll tell you about, the old cells started to divide and had longer telomeres. Wow.
Whoa.
Talk about a holy grail that, you know, that's immediate red flag. Anybody uses the word telomere, bingo, my red flag goes up immediately.
Love those telomeres.
So this research claims that it builds on earlier discoveries made by the Exeter group that shows that a class of genes called splicing factors, these are methodically switched off as we grow older. So these splicing factor cells were found to be switched back on when they were exposed to the chemical and started to behave like physically younger cells, including cell division. So Steve was very smart in pointing out that the article got the chemical name wrong. They originally put in the word as resveratrol. It looks kind of like reversitrol. It's actually the correct chemical is resveratrol.
Yeah.
Which, that's a bad sign as well. But still, I'm holding on by my fingernails because this is the type of news that I want. So they said that this chemical is naturally found in red wine, dark chocolate, red grapes, and blueberries. Now, why does that throw up a flag? Because that sounds an awful lot like antioxidant talk, right?
Yep.
Okay.
So there's just red flags popping left and right here. So our bodies accumulate these senescent cells, and they can no longer divide or function normally. They don't really have that much of a metabolism.
Yeah, but when does apoptosis take over and say, all right, I'm done here?
I mean, if it's not really causing any sort of damage, there's no reason to.
Yeah, they're really not doing anything, Bob, but that's really, at its core, that's the problem. So here, this is the part I found the most interesting. So these cells lose their ability. They use their ability to use genes to communicate to the body. That's really what's going on here. So they use these splicing factors, which are in essence, they're proteins. And the cells, the normal cells can communicate by making many different types of messages that the surrounding tissue can respond to. But these older cells, their splicing factors don't work as well, which means that the cell can't communicate to the surrounding tissue as well. And that's really, at its core, the problem that they've discovered here. And when they apply the resveratrol, It was shown to restore the proper levels of these splicing factors, which translates into the older cells regaining features of younger cells.
Yeah, this is also in fibroblasts in a petri dish, you know.
So yeah, that's true too.
Yeah, well,
keep that in mind as well. So, yeah, I think this is good basic science that is showing one very specific thing. We really don't know what the overall implications of this would be for an organism. We're so many steps away from that, that even saying that this, you know, may contribute to, you know, a restorative or regenerative treatments or anti-degenerative therapies, which is what the authors say in their conclusion, that's a stretch. This is most things at this level, and I mean greater than 99% of the things that we identify at this level of research ever pan out to have a clinical application. So just keep that in mind.
Sure, but it's encouraging. It's encouraging.
Doesn't mean this isn't an interesting little bit of information about, you know, the role of, you know, these mRNA splicing factors in the ability of cells to reproduce. That's basically what we're talking about.
Yep.
Directly relating that to aging, that's spin. That's, you know, a speculation that's really out of the context.
Yeah, it's way too applied.
Yeah, it's the level of the study. But of course, that's
That's the cell.
And you'll notice if you read the actual article, which I have, like the word aging doesn't occur anywhere in the article. Right? I mean, the name of the article is Small Molecule Modulation of Splicing Factor Expression is Associated with Rescue from Cellular Senescence.
See, it says rescue, Steve, and we know what that means.
but senescence is a very specific thing. It's not aging. It is just the inability to reproduce. That's it. So what happens is they start reproducing again. Evan, this is kind of – this is a weird one. It's another medical one. We have a few medical ones. And actually, Carrie, yours is medical too. We have one astronomy and four medical news items this week.
We don't make the news. We report the news.
Evan, you're going to talk to us about these lawsuits alleging that there is a risk or a negative impact of gadolinium, which is an element used sometimes as a contrast material in MRI scans.
Yeah, I am, and I'm actually going to talk about it in the context specifically of one Chuck Norris. Yeah. I have a question for Kara.
Uh-oh, okay.
Do you know who Chuck Norris is?
I do. I'm from Texas.
Okay,
of course
okay
I do.
But in what context do you know Chuck Norris?
Texas.
You heard of
him. I know him from Walker, Texas Ranger.
Okay, all right. Good. Yeah. I was hoping you would say that.
Oh, okay.
Not from Return of the Dragon?
No. I definitely know him from Walker, Texas Ranger, but I do know that doesn't he have a really strong, like, martial arts background, right?
Yes, he does.
That's what he's known for. He legit seriously has a strong I know he's become a joke, but, like, he actually does have that, right?
Yes. Absolutely. Yes, he absolutely does. And my point was there, depending on, you know, sort of what age you fall into, you may have an idea of, you know, Chuck Norris from the 70s or Chuck Norris from the 80s, Chuck Norris from the 90s. Now, there's also this, thing going around sort of in the 2000s, 2010, Chuck Norris facts. You know about
oh,
this?
Oh, yes. Oh, those
satirical
were always like
factoids about
he once did
Chuck
whatever
Norris
with his bare hands. Yeah.
Well, here's a few examples. If you have $5 and Chuck Norris has $5, Chuck Norris has more money than you. Chuck Norris can eat just one Lay's potato chip. Chuck Norris destroyed the periodic table because he only recognizes the element of surprise. and that's three of about 10 million of these things that are out there. So Chuck Norris sort of has taken on this sort of internet life of his own.
I feel like this points to the fact that you and I have a similar sense of humor because the other three guys did not laugh at any of those. And we found them quite funny.
Yeah, but you guys generally laugh more than the rest of us do.
Yeah, that's probably true. We do laugh more than the rest of you. But I laugh at Evan's jokes all the time because they're so funny to
me. Evan has sleeper jokes. He'll throw them out like an invisible bomb, and if you're not listening, you'll miss it.
That's true.
Yeah, but that's why you listen to the show. You know, you catch them later on in the show.
I specifically choose not to laugh about these jokes about Chuck Norris because I don't like him. I really don't like him. I think when Bruce Lee kicked his ass and Entered the Dragon, Bruce Lee kicked his ass in Return of the Dragon, I am. So sorry to the two of you. I should never have made that mistake. When he totaled that freak, he should have kept him down. You know what I'm saying? Because this guy never should have had a second or third career. Done. I'm done talking about
it. So that's it. You were done in 1972. Absolutely. That was pretty much Chuck Norris 72, the end, RIP, right?
Yeah, basically he's an extra in a Bruce Lee movie who did some other stuff later on.
You know? And of course, you know, Walker, Texas Ranger.
Walker, Texas Ranger.
Very well known.
Loser.
It was a popular series. I'm not a fan. I'm just trying to give you some context as to who this person is and why is he in the news and what's going on with Chuck Norris and lawsuits. Well, he and his wife are taking on several medical device manufacturers in a lawsuit filed in California last week, alleging that a chemical, gadolinium, used in MRI imaging scans poisoned his wife. Yeah. The chemical gadolinium is a rare earth metal found in contrast agents used in many MRIs. And it's important because it enhances and improves the quality of MRI images.
It's a contrast agent, meaning that it increases the signal in an MRI scan when it's where it's present, right? Because it's magnetically responsive. It's a magnetic contrast, right? Because MRI scan uses a magnetic field, you know, without getting into too much the technical detail about how MRIs work, but as opposed to like the iodinated contrast you'd use with a CAT scan where it just has to be dense to X-rays. With an MRI, there's no X-rays, right? So you need a different kind of contrast. They need to use something like gadolinium. And what the contrast materials do is normally they will not cross the blood-brain barrier, mm-hmm. right? That's what the blood-brain barrier does. It keeps stuff out of the brain from the blood. But if there's a breakdown in the blood-brain barrier, the contrast material could leak across. And so mm-hmm. it'll essentially highlight any place where you have a breakdown in the blood-brain barrier. A lesion that is, say, actively inflamed, the inflammation breaks down the blood-brain barrier, and then the contrast will light up around that lesion so that you know that, oh, that lesion's actively inflamed. You know, it's not an old just bit of scar tissue I'm looking at an actively inflamed lesion, for example. Or if you have a tumor, tumors break down the blood-brain barrier.
It's not a tumor.
that tumor will light up as well. So it does make it easier to spot certain things, but it also makes other things, it gives you more information about them. They're not necessarily easier to see. You just know that they're active. So it gives you more information in that way.
Okay. So could this woman just be allergic to it?
Yeah, it's possible. Well, there's not a lot of allergy to gadolinium. As far as I'm aware, the only real, other than, you know, anybody could have like a hypersensitivity to things. That's pretty rare with gado, but it does stress out the kidneys. And yeah. It's standard procedure now to check kidney function before doing a gadolinium study. And if the numbers are too high, you know, if they're too out of range, we won't do it.
Okay, so she
kidneys
she
are what have to clear. They have to clear the gadolinium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the only disease that they've associated with gadolinium.
And was that what she had?
No,
Evan.
No, oh. No. And that disease is called nephrogenic systems fibrosis, NSF. Mm. And you're right, Steve. If you've got any sort of kidney problems, they'll always take the safer route and just not use the gadolinium as part of the scan. And gadolinium, it will eventually pass through the body. Recent studies have shown that small amounts can be retained by the organs, such as you said, Steve, the brain, but also perhaps the bones and skin. Now, according to the lawsuit that Chuck Norris and his wife had brought forward, the gadolinium that the doctors injected into her, Gina, the wife, have left her weak and tired with debilitating bouts of pain and a burning sensation. That's what the lawsuit says. The American College of Radiology said in a statement last year that gadolinium-based contrast agents have been used for diagnosis and treatment guidance in more than 300 million patients worldwide since the late 80s, providing crucial life-saving medical information. Now, the Norris's lawsuit acknowledges that there's no official publicly stated link between gadolinium and the symptoms that have been reported, but here's what they are claiming. A couple things. In part because blood and urine tests for gadolinium only became available recently, and most doctors were not aware of any disease other than the NSF, which we talked about. That is a reason why they have brought this lawsuit, and they're saying that they're, you know, with the new tests, there could be new issues that could be discovered. It's considered also, is part of this lawsuit. They're saying, put your conspiracy hats on. They accuse several manufacturers of gadolinium contrast agents of knowing about the risks, but failing to warn consumers.
About what risks again?
about the risks of gadolinium. Exactly. what made up risks are they talking about? Yeah. In other words, they're saying that they know that there are health issues, even though they can't specifically define it to say a disease or something else. But the manufacturers, apparently in their greed, choose to bury some amounts of data and information that they've got so as to keep big gadolinium churning along.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you pretty much have to show that, right? I mean, because no one promises that things are risk-free. But if you're hiding information, then that's always culpable, right? But that's I don't know of any evidence that they've actually done that. So I guess that's their burden of proof. Then they have to prove that the companies that manufactured it were actually hiding data that they had about its safety.
That's right. Which would, you know, open a whole other can of legal worms, among other things. They're seeking $10 million in damages. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration had a report earlier this year about gadolinium. And here's what it says. An FDA review to date has not identified adverse health effects from gadolinium retained in the brain after the use of gadolinium-based contrast agents, GBCAs, for MRIs. All GBCAs may be associated with some gadolinium retention in the brain and other body tissues that they certainly acknowledge, but they're finding no evidence that there is any harmful effects.
Yeah, so we'll have to keep an eye on this and see what comes out of it.
Would you consider this a frivolous lawsuit, Steve? How do you feel about it?
I mean, I don't know enough of the details about what they're alleging to know that that it's frivolous, meaning that they don't deserve to have their day in court. So they're alleging they have information about, you know, the company concealing data. So, okay, show us. You know, what did they know? What did they conceal? You know, how did they violate your patient, you know, autonomy, you know, by withholding this information. But the science that has been established so far shows that it's pretty safe. And this is something that, you know, again, nobody wants to cause injury to patients by doing a diagnostic test. When the knowledge came out about the nephrogenic systemic fibrosis, that immediately changed the protocol. We all got flags. Like, by the way, you can no longer get an MRI with gadolinium until you do kidney function testing and the patient gets cleared. That's standard procedure. So if there were risks, certainly if the medical profession knew about it, we would react to it appropriately, just like we did, you know, with the kidney issue. So it really seems to be hinging on whether or not, you know, any company was hiding data. I have no knowledge about that, so we'll just have to see what they come out with.
Also, how do they intend to prove that weakness, tired, debilitating bouts of pain, burning sensation are even related to
gadolinium
retention?
The standard, legal standard in the U.S. is that they don't have to. It's not, the courts do not require that somebody who has allegedly been harmed by a product, it doesn't have to be in a medical context. They don't have to prove a cause and effect. They just have to prove that it was that it's plausible and that the company was negligent in some way. That's the two components you need. And the reason for that, and this, you can debate whether or not this is appropriate, and certainly historically you can give horror examples on both sides, but the reason for that is they say, well, it could take 10 or 20 years for the science to work itself out, and it's not fair for the public to have no recourse during that time while the science is still uncertain. So they basically are saying that during a period of scientific uncertainty, that uncertainty errs on the side of the potential victim and not the corporation.
Yeah, it's actually not even really about guilt at that point. I mean, it's about plausible culpability, yeah, like you said.
Yeah, it's just, is there a plausible connection and is there any negligence on the part of the company? You don't have to prove a cause and effect. They just acknowledge that the science may not be there yet and they're not going to count that against you.
So, yeah, and for a lot of companies, it's worked into their
It's worked into the cost.
Yeah.
All right, Kara, it is flu vaccine season, at least in the Northern Hemisphere.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I got mine a couple months ago before I started traveling. Have you all gotten yours?
Oh, yeah.
Good. Nope.
Yes.
Ask me why I haven't gotten mine.
Because you've had a really bad cold and they won't give it to you.
Because I'm sick and I can't get it. Yeah, I've been sick for weeks.
Let's talk a little bit about a really cool study that was just published in Scientific Reports. Sorry, it's a Nature publication, so like Nature's the umbrella. But in Scientific Reports on November 2nd, so very recently, called Efficacy of an Adenoviral Vectored Multivalent Centralized Influenza Vaccine. Very similar to your topic, Jay, this study was something very specific, yet a lot of the write-arounds are trying to describe it as a lifelong protection against the flu, which is absolutely not what it is, but it's an interesting vaccine that is multivalent in a really amazing way. So let's talk for a second about what a flu vaccine is, how it works, and why it is that we have to get a different flu vaccine every season. That's because the flu virus mutates really, really rapidly. A flu shot itself usually has a weakened or a dead version of the flu virus, depending on if it's the nasal spray or the injection. It stimulates immunity against hemagglutinin. And hemagglutinin is a protein on the surface of the flu virus, and it's kind of got a shape like a head and a stem. So flu shots are usually inducing immunity against the head of the hemagglutinin protein for, you know, various reasons, but mainly because it's easier. We've been able to manage that. The problem is the flu mutates every year. And so what epidemiologists and health practitioners have to do is, using a lot of like big data, try and determine what's going to be the dominant flu this year, what's going to be the most virulent, and let's protect against that. Sometimes they get it more right than others, but for the most part, getting your flu shot does increase your protection significantly. It's always a good idea to get a flu shot, unless you are somebody who, you know, it's contraindicated, like you have an allergy to albumin, or there's other reason that you can't get a flu shot. That's how most flu vaccines that we use right now work. But what these researchers did, which is really, really interesting, and of course, this was done in mice, so remember that this was not done yet in humans. We're a little beyond the petri dish, like your story, Jay, but we're not quite to humans yet. They decided to look at what they call consensus flu genes. Consensus flu genes are basically really evolutionarily old flu genes. They're ancestral genes that are in these flu viruses, regardless of if they mutate. And they looked at four major flu strain types. They looked at H1, H2, H3, and H5. They actually ended up using 9 different incredibly dangerous flu types. They included some of the worst ones were H1N1 and H3N1, which you guys have heard of. Those are swine flus. H3N2, which is a flu that, you know, humans obviously can get, but it comes from pigs and birds. And then H5N1, you guys remember that as the avian flu or the bird flu. And what they did is they used an adenovirus, which is the virus that actually causes the common cold. They altered it to use it as a vector, and they put these four consensus flu genes, the H1, H2, H3, and H5 genes, into this adenovirus, and they injected mice with 9 different strains of flu after they gave them the ancestral gene, or the consensus gene, vaccine. The doses that they used when they injected the mice were lethal doses. They used, I did not know that that was a thing, but apparently there are doses of the flu that are so high that you will die if you get infected with them. And they found that 100% of the mice that were vaccinated with the ancestral gene vaccine, this new type of vaccine, survived. And all of the mice that had the traditional vaccine from, they used one from the 2010-2011 season, Fluzone and Flumist, the seasonal vaccine from then. So that was the control group, and all of them died. So that's a good sign. So basically, what they tried to do is produce a vaccine, and lots of different people are trying to approach this flu vaccine problem in different ways. Some of them are trying to attack the stem of the hemagglutinin protein instead of the head, because the stem tends to mutate less often. So that could be a really interesting approach. These researchers decided, let's look at what's in the box. Yeah. Did you guys see that Gwyneth Paltrow actually, as much as she bugs shit out of me, she had an epic Halloween costume this year. She just wore a cardboard box on her head. Come on. And it was like open. So genius, right?
I'll give her that.
I know. Anyway.
Yeah, but Cameron, we should point out, though, that the reason that vaccines target the head is because it's exposed. And the stem
it's easier.
Is blocked. So, yeah, the flu virus, essentially, the variable region that mutates all the time is what's exposed to the immune system. And the region that doesn't change from year to year is sort of protected from antibodies. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to get to make antibodies that will attack the stem. It's
absolutely.
That's why we haven't done it.
Yeah, so that's why we don't have those vaccines. Yeah. And so some researchers are really focusing on figuring out how do we get in there? How do we connect it to it? How do we connect it to it in such a way that our own immune system will respond to it once we are connected to it? Basically, these researchers took it a different tack, and they decided we want to put in these consensus genes. And these consensus genes, these kind of evolutionarily older genes, they thought would protect against a larger group of different types of influenza, because they're found in all of them, regardless of whether or not they have mutated. And it seemed to work in the mice, which is super interesting. So, of course, like all the write-arounds that use the word lifelong protection, even this one in Live Science, which is actually a really good write-around by Rachel Rettner, it says lifelong protection against flu, new vaccine shows promise. And I think that that's, you know, a legitimate thing. This vaccine is one step to trying to get to that place eventually. We still have no idea if using this multivalent adenoviral vectored vaccine is dangerous to the human immune system, if it causes any sort of like off-site problems, you know, if it has any side effects. Who knows? We haven't tried this yet in people. That's why we do it in animals first. First, we usually do it in petri dishes, then animals, and then eventually we get to people. But the fact that they had 100% immunity in these mice, where 7 out of the 9 flu viruses that they injected them with were lethal, or should have been lethal, and actually did kill the control mice who only had the seasonal vaccine, that's a really good sign.
Yeah, but I feel like we hear this story every year. Every flu season, it's like universal flu vaccine, finally. You know, it's again, most of these things won't pan
five
out
to 10 years.
All the way.
Yeah.
So,
and also, I mean, I think it's good, though, that we continue to hear the story, because I think the reason we're continuing to hear the story is because they're on to something and they're continuing to iterate. And these researchers are continuing to find new ways to approach the problem and new things that are working just a little bit better than they did before. And that's really how biomedical science works. And so it's great to see that it's not a function of we tried it before and it's just not going to work, so we're screwed. And it's a function of, oh, let's try this new thing. Maybe that will work a little bit better. I like that.
Yeah. Exactly. But I do want people to understand the arc of research. And when you're in this preliminary phase, most things are, statistically speaking, are not going to work out. And that's why this is like the 12th time we've heard about a universal flu vaccine. None of the other ones, they're either still in development, or there's hurdles they haven't got around, or something killed them. And that's also likely the fate of this one, but you never know. This may be the one that hits, or some derivative of this. It's all good, but it's in the preliminary phase. Just understand what that means.
Absolutely. It probably won't work. It definitely won't work for next flu season. So you got to stick with your regular flu vaccine for now. But
for
maybe
now,
and eventually, maybe our children, maybe our children's children will be able to take a flu shot one time that gives them lifelong immunity and that actually protects against mutating flu viruses.
Yeah.
And if that were the case, that would be pretty cool.
Oh boy.
Because we've got to remember, guys, the flu vaccine is necessary. I see this all the time from like privileged people who live in developed countries where they say, I'll just run the risk. I haven't gotten the flu in 5 years. It's not worth it because maybe I'll get sick from the flu vaccine. A, you're not getting sick from the flu vaccine. You may have a minor reaction. You're definitely not getting the flu from it. You might have already caught the flu because the incubation period is, you know, can have a crossover with the activation period of the vaccine. There's all these different things that we have to remember. But the truth of the matter is the flu is and absolutely can be a deadly disease.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And we want to limit it as much as possible.
So many people. And it could kill you, too. I don't want to scare you, but it could, especially if you have a compromised immune system, especially if you're elderly or you're a baby. I don't think many babies listen to the Skeptic's Guide, but they might be.
But if you're healthy, you're protecting other people. That's
exactly.
The key.
Exactly. You don't end up like Jay, you guys. Get your flu vaccine.
All right. Jay, is that your Who's That Noisy for this week?
Oh, God.
Who's That Fleming?
Okay, here we go. Ready?
No light speed.
What is that?
It sounds like a lot of things, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds like something dying.
It sure
not
does.
Not like a living thing, but like a car or something dying.
The thing about that noisy is when you know what it is, you really know what it is. Because I recognize that. I know what it is, and I would never not be able to hear that again. But did you guys have any guesses?
Nope.
Millennium Falcon.
Is it okay. Lung clams?
No. All right, I got a lot of guesses on this one. A lot of them were wrong, but funny. Like Jim Kelly said, it's a potter's wheel spinning down. You know, unless Jim has heard something I've never heard, which I'm sure he has. But, you know, I don't know if a potter's wheel actually has, like, brakes that would make any kind of noise like that. But I thought that was funny. Another listener named Austin wrote in, I thoroughly enjoy the show. I'm a newbie listener, first-time writer. That noisy sounds a lot like... what would happen if you used an auto-tune processor to measure and alter the pitch of wind howling? Sounds a lot like Kanye West. It's inaccurate, but I felt like writing it. Yeah. Thank you for that.
It does?
At least he knows.
Well, Craig Good, a friend of ours from the show, Craig. Said it sounds like a milkshake machine.
Yeah, it does. You're right. Those kind of hurt my spine.
A little bit. That's why I put that in there. It was a tiny little bit of thing in there. However, there were two people here that hit the mark. One of them actually named it. So Dennis Verhoff actually guessed that it was an airplane engine trying to be spun up. You know, like an old style piston airplane engine has something called an inertia starter. Thank you, Dennis. You didn't win, but you came in second. Alexander Vincent actually won, and he totally nailed it. And here's what Alex had to say. He said, hi, guys. The noisy for your latest Who's That Noisy comes from an inertial starter being used and failing to start a radial engine from an aircraft. It uses a heavy flywheel that is spun up with an electric motor or hand crank, which is then connected with a clutch to the crankshaft, causing the engine to turn. The aircraft is possibly Antonov An-2. I hope I didn't pronounce that wrong. Which is one of the more common aircraft still flying that uses this type of starter. Thank you. And you know what? He was right on everything.
That's awesome.
Even the airplane, yeah.
So, hey, can I ask you a question? Did they use that noise for the sound effects in Star Wars?
It's a funny thing for you to ask, Steve. The answer
is... It sounds just like it.
Yes, that is the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah. Oh, so I was right.
Millennium Falcon, sorry, yeah. Yes, that is it. That is the exact noise. Actually, the sound engineer that worked on Star Wars, if any of you know his name... Ben Burtt actually did the soundscape for movies 4, 5, and 6. He invented all of the sounds that you hear in those Star Wars movies. And
you cleaned the lightsaber sounds.
Cool. You know, as much as John Williams' music created the musical landscape, you know, Ben Burtt, you know, he created the sound of R2-D2. He created the sound of the blasters. He created the, you know, the TIE fighters. All of those sounds came out of his mind. He gave a really interesting talk about how he created the engine for the Millennium Falcon, you know, how he created the sounds for it. And at any given time when you're hearing the Falcon, especially when it's starting, he has a mixture of different types of sounds going on at the same time. And in that failed attempt of the Millennium Falcon starting, he has different things like a water pipe creaking. He has an actual airplane engine winding down, a different kind of car motor turning on, all sorts of different things that he weaved together. And when you hear it together, it really does create the sound of the Millennium Falcon that we've grown to, you know, to recognize. But man, it's a mixture of different sounds. It's not just one sound, and it's fantastic. So if you ever have any free time, look up Ben Burtt. Totally deserves an epic nod in sci-fi moviedom, and you
didn't
know, just
he work with Ernie.
No, he didn't. But
hey-o.
When you hear R2-D2 humming, that's Ben's voice.
Neat.
Yep.
No Foley way. Guys are cool. So cool.
Yeah, he's
sound
awesome.
Engineers are fascinating.
All right, what do you got for this week, Jay?
Okay, guys, here's a new noisy for you. I hope you like it. I thought this one was a lot of fun. I'm going to give the listeners a hint. That sound is terrestrial.
Again, it sounds like a science fiction movie.
If you have any idea, or if you heard any awesome noises, or if anyone has a Thanksgiving-based Who's That Noisy, send it in to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, we're going to do one email because it's an interesting follow-up to Bob, the news item you talked about last week at SciCon about lava tubes on the moon. This comes from Carver Bearson from Santa Cruz, and he writes, I am a grad student in planetary science at UC Santa Cruz in planetary science and longtime fan of the show. I have worked with radar data and Grail gravity data and wanted to let you know I think there is still room for skepticism on the recent lava tubes discovery.
Really?
For background, there is almost no debate that there are lava tubes based on the geomorphology of the lunar surface. Some of the best evidence is the skylights we see, which are interpreted as places where the roof of the lava tube has fallen in. The question is, how big are they, and are we seeing a particular lava tube with Grail and the Kaguya? Lava tubes are very small features to see from a spacecraft altitudes. Because of this, the Grail lava tube detection is right at the detection limit, which means it is hard to rule out this is noise. They also require, if the detection is real, really big lava tubes. We are talking several kilometers wide. The gravity on the moon is low, so that in theory, these large lava tubes could support themselves structurally. That said, no one I have talked with understands how such a large lava tube would form. The radar observations are also interesting, but not clear-cut in my opinion. Ideally, in radar, you want to have enough observations you can map out a feature so you are sure it is not one of error. It's not a one-off error. Because these things are so small and the spacecraft is moving so fast over the surface, they have a few single radar pulses for their detection. My current stance is we have two detections, which are both right on the edge of being noise. The fact that both methods are giving some agreement in this one area does bolster their case, but I don't think it makes it a sure thing. He also says, to correct an offhand comment, I think the community is in good agreement that lunar core is molten still based on lunar seismic data. Actually, we did correct that on the show. Somebody asked, and I said, yes, the core is still molten. It is not solidified all the way through. So thanks for confirming that.
Yeah, I knew that the radar pings were not optimal at all because it wasn't really designed to detect that. And the Grail, my take was that the Grail was much more confident than the radar. I did not know or come across anything that said that it was at the edge of detection, and that's fine if that's true. The other thing though is that also when researching lava tubes, my understanding was that they could get that big by multiple passes of lava. You know, because if they're used over and over, each time it's used, it gets
a
bit bigger.
Yeah.
So that's one way they could that it could get so big. But so yeah, so it's a little disappointing that maybe it's not as quite as slam dunk as I had thought. But I still got some hope, and hopefully when they do another pass with some other method, they'll confirm that.
All right, guys. Well, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. We have three regular news items this week, no theme. You guys ready?
Yes.
Yep.
Here we go. Doctors report that they successfully transplanted genetically modified skin derived from stem cells to over 80% of a patient's body. Item number two, a new study finds that stimulating the frontal lobes in order to increase analytical thinking reduces the level of supernatural beliefs in subjects. And item number three, astronomers report the first discovery of a star that underwent multiple supernova explosions over 50 years and somehow survived. Jay, why don't you go first?
This first one, doctors, they report that they successfully transplanted genetically modified skin derived from stem cells. Well, over 80% of patients. Wow. Steve, can I get any more info on the genetically modified comment here? Like, is it from the person's own body?
Yes.
Okay, so they GM'd someone's stem cells. Man, that would be fantastic if it was true. Okay, I like that one. Second one here, a new study finds that stimulating the frontal lobes in order to increase analytical thinking reduces the level of supernatural beliefs. Wow, that's pretty powerful too. If you stimulate, so I'm assuming they're stimulating the frontal lobes probably with electricity and not by dangling porn in front of the person, right?
Directly stimulating them, yeah.
I have a lot of good and bad feelings about this because I've read and heard quite a bit about stimulating the brain with electricity or magnetic fields or whatever, you know, and believed a lot of it early on, and then found out that it wasn't, you know, as powerful or as true as a lot of places were reporting. No big surprise there. So this seems like one of those claims. Let me just go to number three. Hopefully I'll get an easy one here. Astronomers report the first discovery of a star that underwent multiple supernova explosions over 50 years and somehow survived. I don't believe that. I mean, come on. Multiple supernova explosions? Is it even a supernova if the entire mass of the star doesn't explode and go out? I mean, maybe it was super small supernovas and it kind of recollected. Wait, over 50 years? No. No way. Nope. That one's fake. It's got to be.
Okay, Evan?
All right. So for the transplanted of the genetically modified skin derived from stem cells. Yeah, I this is neat. Stem cell, you know, just grow them some more skin. I guess 80% of a patient's body is the key here. Can you get that much out of it? And the genetically modified component of it. But it's neat, and I don't see a problem with it. The next one about stimulating the frontal lobes in order to increase analytical thinking to reduce levels of supernatural beliefs in subjects. So I guess the takeaway here is the correlation between analytical thinking and supernatural beliefs. The more you increase your analytical thinking, therefore your supernatural beliefs go together. They're tied. Boy, if that were all it were, I don't know if it's that simple. Brain's very complex. I don't know if it's that simple. And then this last one, I don't quite understand because about the supernova explosions. So a star underwent multiple supernova explosions. How does a star go under? I don't understand how a star is subject to multiple supernova explosions. I mean, a star goes under the explodes and that's it. I mean, I guess it can reconstitute itself, but it takes a long time, doesn't it? Multiple times over 50 years. How could this possibly be? And somehow survived. See, there's a lot of disconnect here for me. I'm not understanding this one. So I don't know what to make of it. So therefore, I'm going to go to the analytical thinking and supernatural beliefs. I don't think they're tied. So I'm going to say that that one's the fiction.
Okay, Kara?
After successfully transplanted genetically modified skin derived from stem cells to cover 80% of a patient's body. Well, I think this has been the goal for a really long time. I think that we've done a lot of really cool stuff with skin grafts, and we're getting better and better and better at it. We can do spray-on stem cell skin grafts already. It's not that big of a stretch that we'd be able to do it in such a large... I mean, that's crazy, though. If somebody needed 80% of their skin replaced... Wow, they are very sick. They would die if they couldn't get that. That's like not your entire immune system, but that's
yeah.
A
but you're almost dead at that point.
Yeah, exactly. So I hope that this one is science. Study finds that stimulating the frontal lobe in order to increase analytical thinking. Would it really just? I mean, yeah, your executor, but. I don't know. I find that's like weird wording. It's not specific enough. Increase analytical thinking. Reduces the level of supernatural beliefs in subjects. This one seems like this one is a red flag to me all over because I don't think supernatural beliefs have anything to do with frontal lobe functioning. I mean, yes, your executor is probably somewhat in charge, but I think there are probably real intense limbic situations happening there. These are very like deep emotional. I think there's a lot of hippocampal stuff there. Yeah, it's like too compartmentalized that you would just like zap your frontal lobe especially. And all of a sudden you're like thinking so much about the future and you have such a strong executor that your supernatural beliefs go out the window. It doesn't make sense. I could see it like maybe helping with ADHD symptoms, but I don't know. This one seems like weird. And astronomers report first discovery of a star that underwent multiple supernova explosions over 50 years and somehow survived. That seems like a short time span. No, I have no idea how long a supernova takes. Maybe that's supposed to take 5 minutes. Also, so they can explode and come back and explode and come back. I don't know. I don't know enough about this, so I'm going to assume it's true because this happens a lot. You'll have some astronomy one. I'll be like, I don't know. That sounds right. And then Bob's like, what? How is that possible?
Is it any coincidence Bob is going last?
Right. So I don't know. I'm going to say that that one is the science also. And I'm going to agree with Evan. I'm going to say it's a little too simple to say that the frontal lobes would decrease supernatural beliefs when they're stimulated.
And Bob.
Yeah. Okay. So regarding the stem cells, yeah, we've been kind of working towards that. I'm not so shocked at all that they're able to, you know, take those stem cells, do some genetic modifications and grow skin and put it back. Yeah, 80% is huge, but it's not like this like holy crap moment, you know, in terms of like, that's not possible. The third one. Yeah, Jay, I understand what you're saying there. Just like supernova every, you know, 50 years ago and what the hell's going on. But, when it's like crazy astronomy stuff, because, oh my God, it's so awesome out there. But, yeah, some things you guys aren't considering perhaps is that you can't figure out how that could be, but astronomers are in the same boat you are. They might be like, what the hell? They don't know either. So I think that's definitely, that's certainly, you know, surprising, but not like impossible.
Not implausible.
You could say it sounds implausible too, but still, I've got more of a problem with the second one about the stimulating the frontal lobes. That you guys made good points about that, especially Kara. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. That's just too simple and doesn't really gel properly. But I do have a lot of hope for stimulating the brain to do cool stuff. I don't think that this has been done. So I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay. So why don't we start with number one, since you all agree with that one. Doctors report that they successfully transplanted genetically modified skin derived from stem cells to over 80% of a patient's body. You all think that is science. And that one is science. Very Ooh. Cool.
Genetically modified.
That is so poor nice.
Kid. This poor they kid, had, man.
They
You're
had
right.
To,
he was near death. He was yeah, near yeah. death.
They Bob had to genetically modify. Yeah. So this was not a burn victim or anything like that. This was a 7-year-old boy who had epidermolysis bullosa, which is a genetic disease, actually a category of genetic diseases. And he had a severe, rare form of this disease.
So imagine your outer skin layer is not adhering to your lower skin layers.
Oh, no.
And, not good. So, it's like you got a skin suit
on. It's
like ichthyosis,
kind of?
No, it doesn't form like scaly things. It's bullosa, which means that it forms blisters. So
it's levelosa.
So with the slightest trauma, you just bump into something and then your skin forms a blister and then peels off. And so it's constantly being exposed. The treatment is just to bandage it. This one report said that it's not uncommon for a patient to spend $100,000 a year on bandages to constantly redress these wounds that keep propping up.
Oh my gosh.
And then of course, so you know, with pain. As you say, it's an important part of the immune system. You get septic, you get infections. And so this 7-year-old kid who had this severe form of it was basically septic and near death and, in Germany, and his doctors contacted these other doctors in Italy who were working on experimental treatment, and they said, hey, you know, this kid's near death, so if you got anything, let's give it a try. So what they had to do was they cultured his skin cells. Now, of course, the skin cells themselves are genetically abnormal, so they can't just, you know, put his own skin cells back on. They had to modify them. So they actually used a retrovirus to replace to insert a working copy of the broken gene, you know, in that causes this disease. They then cultured normal skin, but from the kid's own skin, you know, a normal version of that had been genetically fixed. And then they took the sheets of the skin cells that they grew and they transplanted it over the areas that were not intact, which was 80% of his body, like his entire back, his limbs, part of his stomach, his face. That they actually
his
did that 2 years ago.
Oh, and, wow.
2 years?
Yeah. And so they're reporting basically that it's been successful, that it took.
That's
you
awesome.
Know,
and how old was the kid when he had to do it?
Seven.
Oof. Can you imagine? That's 7 years of his life living with that disease before he even underwent this.
Right.
So 7 years, that's still young enough where, you know, your healing powers are still pretty amazing. I wonder how – I mean, I remember reading stories about like – well, maybe not seven-year-olds, but babies growing back like partial fingers, like the last – you know, like finger. I mean, the younger you are, you've got some amazing, you know, Wolverine-like abilities. But I mean, I wonder how he looks today. And I'm sure he's a million times better off than he was, but I still can't help thinking, you know, in terms of like, you know, being able to socialize with people and strangers and things is, you know, I hope he looks good.
Well, he's probably not covered in blisters and bandages. Right, so if you think about it, like, was it on his face at all?
Yes.
That's a hard part.
I can't help but being curious. How does it look when you transplant that much skin? What does it look like? I've seen burn victims.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's a life-saving procedure and it's awesome, but it's still unfortunate that it's not perfected even more to make it look more realistic.
It always looks fine, but abnormal, right? Like you can tell that the skin's been grafted, but at least the skin itself looks healthy.
The kid's life got saved, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. He was literally
on death's door.
Yeah, he was on death's door. It was like, that was it. He was going to die, and he would have died. So this is fantastic, and it's a wonderful, you know, advance for sure.
And they were very concerned about the retrovirus because this is the same retrovirus that in the early 2000s in a clinical trial caused leukemia.
Uh-oh.
But so far, there's no signs of any cancer.
I remember that.
Yeah,
that
cancer
really
genes
put a pall
being activated.
Over the whole endeavor back then, it really killed it. But wait, why couldn't they just use like a CRISPR-Cas9 type of technique? They used a completely different technique?
Yeah. Well, they weren't trying to alter. I mean, they had to insert an entire gene, and I'm not sure if you could do that with CRISPR. Actually, that's a good question. You know, they weren't altering a gene or taking
a couple base pairs.
Yeah, they were splicing in an entire gene. So that's an interesting question. I have to look into that. But anyway, retrovirus, before there was CRISPR, there was retroviruses. You know, that's how we did it. But as you said, it's been very problematic. But so this is encouraging and this is a single case report. So let's keep that in mind as well. You know, it's significant, which is why they reported on it. But it's hard to extrapolate too much or to generalize from one case.
But well, it tells
in this
us it's
case
possible.
It worked. Yeah, it's plausible. Yeah. In this case, it worked, at least for 2 years. Okay, let's go to number three. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Astronomers report the first discovery of a star that underwent multiple supernova explosions over 50 years and somehow survived. Again, Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah,
Sorry,
baby.
Jay. Woot.
Bob,
blame
so
the flu
obvious
fog.
When you've read the news item.
I try not to be obvious.
I know.
This one, I got to say, this one was hilarious because in how many years have we been doing this? What, 3 or 4?
Yeah.
How many years? No, 3 or 4 years we've been doing this. This is the first time I literally read two of them, and I know the news item you bastardized to make the fiction. It was like, holy crap, I'm so awesome. Getting this one. That's rare as shit.
Yeah, but these items, I knew that, you know, these items really stuck out.
Yeah.
I knew that you guys probably would have seen some of them.
I had read I had seen the headlines on the skin one.
Yeah.
I remember 80%, but I didn't read the article, so I could have, you know.
Yeah,
you
could have swapped something.
That's where Steve screws you.
Yeah, I didn't know it was GMO. Exactly.
Steve really screws you hard when that happens.
Yeah.
But I had to use these items because they were all so cool. I had to talk about
them. What am I not understanding about supernova explosions?
Nothing, Evan. Nobody understands this.
Nobody
gets it. The astronomers are like, what the hell is going on? So first of all, Kara, supernova lasts about 100 days.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right. So they are faster than I.
Yeah. 100 days. So they typically they will brighten and then dim, and they go through certain changes that are characteristic, that are the signature of a supernova explosion, changes to their spectra, for example. And so what they found, in observing this star is that it went through the typical spectral changes, the signature of a supernova. Like 3 years ago, and then did it again, and then did it again, like 5 times in the last few years. Then they looked back and they found, you know, from 50 years ago in archived data, a supernova in this exact same location, as if that same star, you know, had gone supernova 50 years ago. Now, they say that there is a theoretical way in which a star can undergo multiple supernovae. Because, again, the normal supernova that we understand and that we have observed, the star collapses on the core and then explodes most of its material away, leaving behind a remnant core, and that's it. It's done, right? The star blows itself up, you know, leaving behind just a remnant, which could be a white dwarf or a neutron star or a black hole, depending on the size of the star, that nova is, right?
Yeah.
But in this case, you know, obviously there was enough material left behind that it could do it again. And even if it went through it 50 years ago, it was still around to do it multiple times in the last few years. So they just straight up don't understand this. But there is a theoretical situation in which a star could undergo more than one supernova. It's called a pulsational pair instability supernova. However, these theoretical entities should only have been around early on in the universe. They shouldn't be around anymore. And the observations of this star doesn't quite fit the predictions for this pulsational pair instability supernova. So that's probably not a good explanation.
Hmm.
So basically, astronomers have no idea what's going on with this star.
Okay. All right. They're lost and I'm lost. I'm all right with
that. It's an anomaly. Yeah, they say the energy released by the star is more than the theory predicts for that pulsational pair instability supernova. So something funky is going on.
Aliens.
Either way. Yeah.
It's right. Gotta be intelligent life. Intelligent right. life.
All of this means that a new study finds that stimulating the frontal lobes in order to increase analytical thinking reduces the level of supernatural beliefs in subjects is the fiction.
Woohoo!
But yeah, this was based on an actual study. Now, this is not as implausible as you may think because there is a literature base that does suggest that analytical thinking is inversely correlated with belief in religious beliefs or supernatural beliefs, and that intuitive thinking is more predictive of religious or supernatural beliefs. But this study didn't show that. They did not find a correlation between intuitive thinking and supernatural beliefs. And when they tried to stimulate the analytical parts of the brain, that had no effect on measurements of supernatural belief.
Well, because you also can't, like, you can't localize intuition that easily. Just
not
because
intuition,
that might be a dichotomous.
But analytical.
Yeah, that's true.
Is what they were
so
trying
just,
to stimulate.
But that's like making two assumptions that like,
yeah.
you know, which both of them might be true. But like just because that's a dichotomous factor or construct, it doesn't mean that there's a dichotomous neurological correlate to it, you know?
Yeah, well, that's why it's the fiction.
Yeah.
But they also didn't find in their cohort, they did not find a relationship between intuitive thinking style and supernatural belief. What they did find correlated was simply the culture, what you were raised to believe. And that makes sense.
Imagine
that like, if you have certain belief structure that, because that's what you were, grew up with, whatever your inherent neurological proclivities are in terms of analytical versus intuitive thinking, or stimulating one part of your brain or another, isn't going to change your culture. It's not going to change your learned
beliefs
or narrative.
Or your multiplicative proclivities.
Yeah. So that kind of makes sense too, you know, that, you know, what they found. But that is what this study showed. So it does call into question some previous studies that did suggest that there may have been an association between intuitive thinking and religious beliefs or supernatural beliefs.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me that culture would be the primary deciding factor.
Yeah, there's so much when it comes to religion or, you know, mythology or mysticism, all that kind of stuff. It's not just that you're less analytic. Like, there's so many things. There's so many memories tied to it. There is a strong emotional component. Like, I just don't see it being so localized.
That is correct. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All interpretations made by a scientist are hypotheses, and all hypotheses are tentative. They must forever be tested, and they must be revised if found to be unsatisfactory. Hence, a change of mind in a scientist, and particularly in a great scientist, is not only not a sign of weakness, but rather evidence for continuing attention to the respective problem and an ability to test the hypothesis again and again. And that was Ernst Mayr.
Yeah, Ernst Mayr, baby.
Nice.
Yes. One of the 20th century's leading evolutionary biologists, renowned taxonomist, tropical explorer, ornithologist, philosopher of biology, and historian of science.
Yeah.
What a renaissance man.
So, but I do think that I agree with the essence of that quote. It does require a little bit of explanation because that doesn't mean that all hypotheses are equal, right? That, sure, everything is tentative pending further evidence, interpretation, you know, hypotheses. Of course, somebody may come up with a better hypothesis that accounts for the data better or new data, which calls it into question. Absolutely. But there are some hypotheses that have been so well established that they have broader explanatory power, you know, and then there are some that have been so well established that it's okay, that it's reasonable to treat them as tentative facts. And right. So it doesn't mean that we don't know anything and that everything is a guess. It just means that anything is potentially open to revision by new evidence. The probability may be very low. I don't think we're going to discover tomorrow, again, that the Earth is a cube, right? I mean, that's just not going to happen. Or that, you know, life on Earth.
You've not read my white paper.
Really was created 7,000 years ago. I mean, that's not good. Yeah, just not going to happen.
That evolution isn't real.
Yeah.
Well, what hits home for me in this quote is that changing your mind when you're a scientist is not a sign of weakness. In fact, it's a necessary part of being a scientist. And I think
it's kind of a sign of a not very good scientist if you dig your heels in.
Yes.
Which a lot of scientists do because it's human nature.
Sure.
But it doesn't mean you're the best scientist.
But all the other scientists think you're a nerd when you do that. And I'm serious, because I've been there. Yeah. I've been like in discussions among colleagues. It's like, oh yeah, this guy, man, he's clinging to this preferred hypothesis beyond all reason. I was like, that's the kind of thing that makes your colleagues talk negatively about you.
Yeah, well, especially I think it especially happens when it's like somebody was the author of the hypothesis.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And they've dedicated their whole career to it. It's super hard to give that up.
Yeah, I mean, some ideas are so entrenched that people like literally scientists have to wait for the changing of the guard and have them die before you got major belief updates, because it's like some things are just so entrenched they're not really going to go anywhere, even for scientists.
Yeah, I can't remember who said the quote, but yeah, somebody observed that science advances funeral by funeral.
I
gotta look that up.
It depends on the science, I think. And I think it also was more true a couple hundred years ago when that was said, or 100 years ago, than it is today. I think the faster moving the science, the less that's true. Like 100 to 200 years ago, when like a hypothesis could survive for 50 years, you know, and become ingrained, so ingrained that it would be very hard to get rid of. Yeah, the old guard would basically have to die.
Yeah, and it was siloed as hell.
Yeah, exactly. It was indoctrinated. Mm-hmm. But now, it's like there isn't even time, you know, to get, for a hypothesis to get too embedded before there's new evidence that's modifying it or changing it or rejecting it. So,
hey, Steve.
Yeah.
So I'm leaving on Monday to go to Australia, New Zealand, and Hong Kong, and I'm doing it with the Australian skeptics, the New Zealand skeptics, and the Hong Kong, and also the Chinese skeptics. And so I'm going to be making all these great appearances at the Athenaeum Theatre in Melbourne. I will be speaking on Friday, November 17th with Alan Duffy. We're doing a great talk called Beyond the Eye, which will be about a lot of cool ways that both physics, because he's a physicist, and also psychology can play tricks on how we perceive different things. Then on November 19th, if you're in Sydney, you can come see me at the Skepticon conference. And of course, that's with our friends, the Australian skeptics. I'll be doing a talk called Science Communication in Post-Truth America. And then in New Zealand, their conference is from the 24th to the 26th in Wellington, and I'll be speaking at some point during that conference. And then lastly, if you are in Hong Kong or Dongguan, China, you can go to Meetup and find the details of my entire schedule there at the Hong Kong Skeptics and Dongguan, China Skeptics.
Sounds like an awesome trip.
I know. I'm so excited.
Well, everyone, thanks for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Good to be here.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.